Now I'm questioning Yates' story too, Yuki said. I want to talk with him again, drill down hard on his story, and either debunk it or settle down the questions in my mind.
Sounds right, Yuki said.
I've called Paul at home and at work. I've left messages and I've texted him, but he hasn't gotten back to me. Why not? So before I turn nothing into something, can you run Mark Christopher and Paul Yates through NCIC for me? Both of them?
I said, Yates like the poet?
Y-A-T-E-S, she said. Paul G.
I accessed NCIC, the FBI's National Crime Information Center, and typed in Mark Christopher. It took only a few minutes to assure myself that Mark Christopher wasn't in it. He was clean. I've found nothing on Mark, I told Yuki.
Okay, good, she said.
She got to work on the meatloaf on rye. I typed in Paul G. Yates and let the software run. I was about to say nothing on him either when Paul Gentry Yates popped up in the supervised release file. It was an arrest sheet from 10 years ago when Paul Yates was a college kid of 19. Yuki, I found something you're going to want to see. I pressed keys and the printer chugged out the arrest report. I wheeled my chair around, took the report out of the tray, and handed it to Yuki. She read it, then looked up at me with shock on her face.
I've got to get this to Red Dog, she said. Fast.
Chapter 90. Yuki shoved her chair back from Conklin's desk and ran, calling back to Lindsay.
I have to be back in court in 30 minutes.
Lindsay yelled, good luck, as Yuki made for the fire exit and ran down one flight to the third floor. It was a short dash along the corridor to Parisi's office. The DA was in a closed-door meeting, but Yuki couldn't wait, and Len wouldn't want her to. She announced to his gatekeeper,
it's urgent,
and without waiting for a reply, swept past Tony's desk and barged into her boss's office announcing,
I've got to speak with you right now.
Parisi told the two men in his office to hang on a minute, stepped out into the corridor, and asked Yuki what was wrong.
Paul Yates, she said. He tried to extort a professor when he was in college.
And? Where does that go? Parisi asked.
Okay, Yuki said. 10 years ago, when he was at UCLA, Yates threatened to expose his sociology professor for using inappropriate language unless he gave him a passing grade. The professor addressed it head-on and took it to the dean, who called the cops. Yates was arrested. Judge gave him a year of probation, and Yates was kicked out of school.
The spur of the hallway outside Len's office was starting to fill up. Yuki turned her back and continued.
Len, I would never have believed Paul Yates was capable of extortion. He's timid.
Len said,
it's a red flag, I agree, but it doesn't mean that he perjured himself against Hill.
I'm connecting the dots this way, Yuki said. Paul knows Mark, and he tells him about his UCLA escapade. Brianna has testified that she was starting to lose interest, and Mark got the message. He feels aggrieved and also greedy. Paul's extortion gives him an idea. So he sets Brianna up and tries to blackmail her. Hill tells him to bug off.
Parisi said.
So now Mark is mad.
Correct. He's warned her and she's not going for it, so it's time to make her pay up. Mark takes the sex video to the cops. He's emotional. He's got faded ligature marks on his wrists and ankles. He's got a video. Of course they buy it, and so do we. We charge Brianna.
Theoretically.
Len, my theory that Mark and Paul colluded is speculative. This thought occurred to me when Mark told his new and improved story on the stand. Were old memories just coming to him? Or was he lying? And if he was lying, I have to ask, is his whole story a lie?
Len looked perturbed, but he was hanging in with her. Yuki said,
in sum, we've got a witness with a history of extortion. I can't prove that Mark was untruthful, but I'm questioning his veracity. As for the defendant, her testimony was heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking as in good acting? Or heartbreaking she's been framed?
Yuki shrugged.
I'm on the fence. I want some evidence before we ditch.
The prosecution had a legal obligation to withdraw charges if the case against Brianna Hill was wrong. If Yuki proceeded without confidence in the defendant's guilt, she could get disbarred. She said,
I need to talk to Yates again. If he changes his story, says he made up what he said happened between him and Brianna, I'll go back to Mark and squeeze him until he yelps. Can you ask Rathburn for a continuance?
I'll give it a shot, Len said.
Parisi used Tony's desk phone and called Judge Rathburn. In 25 words or less, he explained the new situation to the judge, who agreed to recess court until tomorrow morning.
It's a gift, Parisi said to Yuki. Make the most of it.
Chapter 91. As Yuki headed toward her office, she phoned Arthur and left him a message, updating him on the situation, including that court was adjourned until morning. She had just gotten back to her desk when her phone rang. She said into the mouthpiece,
Art? It's Cindy.
There were very few people Yuki would be willing to talk to in the middle of this mess, but Cindy was on the short list. Yuki said,
I'm kinda in a rush.
Cindy said,
Me too. Did you hear?
Maybe not, said Yuki. Tell me.
This is a girlfriend-to-girlfriend heads-up, Cindy said. I got it off the police scanner, and I made a couple of follow-up calls to confirm. Paul Yates. He's your witness, right?
Right. What about him?
He committed suicide this morning. He hanged himself.
Yuki sat down hard behind her desk.
No! That can't be true!
Cindy assured her that her sources were good.
I'm posting a cloaked version of this story to my crime blog in about 10 minutes, Cindy said. Claire should have Yates's body by now, so talk to her.
Yuki sat for a moment, trying to put this news flash in the context of her meeting with Parisi and her past meetings with Yates, and to consider the impact of his death on her case, which was coming apart at high speed, the wheels flying off and littering the roadway. Cindy said,
Yuki. Yuki?
I'm here. I'm just stunned, that's all. Thanks, Cindy.
Yuki hung up with Cindy, phoned Claire's office, and was told that Claire wasn't available. She asked to speak with Claire's lab assistant, Bunny Ellis. After several crazy-making minutes of 80s Muzak, Bunny got on the line.
Bunny, this is ADA Castellano. Do you have the body of Paul Yates?
Uh-huh. Claire's with him now.
Yuki had to know for sure. Was Paul's death a homicide, a suicide, an accident, or undetermined? She said to Bunny,
He was a witness in my case. How long before we have a determination in manner and cause of death?
I'll have Claire call you, okay?
Wait. Bunny, do you have the name of the officer or officers who called it in?
Once Yuki had the names of the first officers, she called Lindsay and asked her to look up the report.
Okay, I've got the file, said Lindsay. What it says is that Paul Yates was found dead in his apartment this morning by his girlfriend, who was worried when he didn't answer his phone. He used a clothesline tied to his bedroom doorknob, strung over the top of the door, knotted around his neck. It's written up as an apparent suicide. Yuki texted Parisi and then called Arthur again. After she briefed him, he asked,
What do we do now?
I want to speak with Mark Christopher.
How can I help?
Go to the ME's office and wait for Yates's death certificate. I'll leave word that you're there.
Chapter 92. Something was happening to me that I didn't understand. I was swimming in darkness, surrounded by garbled voices. I was both numb and cold, and my head hurt. Is this a really bad dream? Hands plucked at me. Someone slapped my cheek. I wanted to sink back into the swirl of underwater, but consciousness intruded. Whatever was happening was too real to be a dream. I opened my eyes. A patch of the floor came into focus, and I recognized the pattern of the ceramic tiles. A row of half doors filled my peripheral view, and then there were the shoes. Pale-colored shoes with sponge soles. Red ballet flats? I knew then that I was in the ladies' room at the end of the hall from the squad room. I was lying half under a sink, but I didn't remember coming here. Brenda, our PA, yelled into my face. Her expression scared me.
Lindsay, can you hear me? She shouted. What the heck happened?
She was terrified. Had I been shot? I said, I don't know. That was the whole truth and nothing but. I wasn't ready to move, but I lifted my head and tried to make sense of the clamor. Paramedics had crammed into the small bathroom and were attempting to lift me onto a stretcher. I fought back. What had happened to me? A man stooped down. His name was stitched above his pocket. A. Murphy.
I'm Andy, he told me. Can you remember what happened to you?
He had other questions, and I tried to answer them. In the ladies' room. Lindsay Boxer. Two fingers. Wednesday. George Washington. I'm fine.
I'll be the judge of that, Lindsay. Now tell me the last thing you remember.
This was the second time I said this, and it was still the truth. I don't know what happened. Another paramedic pricked my finger. Someone put a stethoscope to my chest. Andy shined a light into one eye, then the other.
That's good, Lindsay, he said.
Fingers pressed across my wrist as Andy asked me more questions about my health. History of heart disease, previous episodes of blacking out, name of GP, last time I'd had a checkup. I struggled to sit up. I had pain in my shoulder and my forehead. I remember now. I came in here to wash my hands before having lunch. I must have passed out. Andy said,
That sounds right. Syncope. Your blood glucose is about normal. Your blood pressure is within normal range.
And he asked me to help him out by getting onto the stretcher. There was no way they could carry me out the narrow doorway on that thing. My strength was coming back, and so was my mind. I was feeling madder. I said, I'm fine, Andy. Please let me up. I've fainted once or twice before when I haven't eaten. I haven't eaten today. I've been busy. Look, will someone just help me the fuck up? Hands went under my armpits. I was hoisted onto my feet. I felt woozy, but with the support of strong hands and a counter of sinks, I stood steady as a rock. I'm okay, see? Andy Murphy said,
There's a pretty big knot coming up on your forehead. Emergency docs should check you out at Metro, give you a CT scan. If you were my sister, I'd insist on that. It's the right thing to do, Lindsay.
Thanks, no. I'll call my husband. He'll drive me home.
We can't make you come with us, but you do have to sign this, said the paramedic, handing me a release.
I signed it with a flourish. I thanked everyone. Brenda walked with me to my desk and I called Joe. I was scared, but I tried not to let him hear the throbbing freakout in my voice. I still hadn't made an appointment to see Dr. Glenn Arpino, but I had to do it. I couldn't justify putting it off any longer. Problem was, I was pretty sure that I now knew what was wrong with me. It was a terrifying thought, and I couldn't bear it. So I shoved it to the back burner. I would deal with it tomorrow. Chapter 93. Yuki watched Mark Christopher squirm in one of the two metal frame chairs across from her desk. He leaned his crutch against the second chair. She moved her lamp a few inches, placed her phone where Mark could see it, and pressed record.
I'm recording our meeting.
Why?
You have a problem speaking on the record, Mark?
I guess not. But why do you want to do it?
I want to ask you some questions about Paul Yates,
Yuki said.
I've seen his death certificate. It's official. Suicide by hanging. Do you have any idea why he killed himself?
Mark's defiance withered, and it looked like tears were about to spring out of his eyes. Yuki really didn't care. Mark cleared his throat a couple of times and said,
I just heard. It's horrible. I haven't spoken with Paul since, I don't know, a week. I don't know what to say.
Yuki asked him again.
Mark, do you have any thoughts why he would have hanged himself?
You're asking if it's about what happened during the trial?
Yuki didn't answer, just kept her eyes on Mark. Mark said,
Maybe you're right. Oh, man.
He's a pretty sensitive guy.
Was.
I shouldn't have even told you about him. You would never have even heard his name if it weren't for me. Oh, my God. I don't know what to do or say. I want it all to stop.
Did you know that when Paul was in college, he was arrested for trying to blackmail a professor?
Mark looked at her as if she were pointing a gun at him. He said,
No. Of course not.
Yuki slapped her desk.
Stop lying to me!
He recoiled, then said,
Okay, Paul told me about what he did in college. I don't see what that has to do with anything. It was harmless.
Look, Yuki, I want you to drop the charges against Brianna. This has gotten out of hand. Can we just draw this whole thing to a close?
Drop the charges? You mean I should tell the judge what, Mark? The prosecution changed its mind?
Can you do that?
Tell me what happened with you, Paul, and Brianna, she said.
What more is there to tell?
He asked her.
Plenty. Feel free to fill in the blanks.
Yuki took a sheet of paper out of a folder on her desk and flashed it at Mark.
This is Paul's suicide note.
No, please. Please don't read it to me.
I'll skip around, Yuki said. Paul said that he's sorry. He didn't mean to lie about Brianna. He wishes he'd never met you, Mark. He wishes he'd aimed higher when he shot you at your request.
Mark was saying,
Oh, God. Oh, God,
and crying now, hands over his eyes. Compared with the tears he had shed on the witness stand, this was a very ugly cry. Yuki went on.
Here's a quote. Please tell Brianna I know what I did was wrong, and I am more sorry than she can ever know or believe for hurting her. I hope one day she can forgive me. That's about it, Mark. And he wrote an apology to his girlfriend and his parents for taking his life.
She gave the criminal liar sitting across from her direct eye contact.
Mark, was this accusation that Brianna Hill raped you a lie?
He nodded.
Speak up, Mark. Is that a yes?
Yuki asked.
Yes. It was what she said it was. A game.
You and Paul cooked this up together? To frame her for rape and blackmail her?
It was my idea,
Mark said, his voice just barely audible.
Paul helped me.
Helped you plan?
Yuki asked.
Yes.
And he shot you?
I asked him to do it.
But you were going to cut him in?
Yes to all of that,
Mark told Yuki. He looked broken, and Yuki felt that he was finally telling the truth.
Why, Mark? Why did you do this?
He grabbed the arms of the chair and lunged toward her, shouting,
Can't you see what a ball buster she is?
There it was, his anger and his venom. His dark side that he'd used to bring down Brianna Hill. It would now fuel his own reversal of fortune. Yuki drew back and said,
Oh my God.
Mark sagged in the chair. His voice was breaking when he asked,
What's going to happen to me?
I'll let you know. Stay here.
Mark said,
I'm going to be sick.
That makes two of us.
Yuki reached under her desk, pulled out the trash can, and walked it over to where Mark was slumped over his knees. She handed him the wastebasket and said,
You're despicable.
She picked her phone up off the desk, left the room, and walked down the hall to Red Dog's office. He was waiting for her. Chapter 94 Yuki parked her car on Clayton Street, in front of the pretty, shingled condo building where Brianna Hill lived. She grabbed her car keys and stepped out onto the tree-shaded residential block, walked up stone steps and under a trellis. She paused for a moment, checking her anxiety level, and then rang the doorbell. She heard footsteps, the click of the peephole followed by the clack of the lock. And there was Brianna in her pink and blue striped pajamas, smelling of liquor at 3 in the afternoon.
What are you doing here?
Brianna asked her.
Hi, Brianna. May I come in?
I can't speak with you without my lawyer present, you know that.
Mr. Giftos is with D.A. Parisi right now,
Yuki told her.
He knows that I'm here, and he knows why. It's okay with him, but of course you should call him if you like.
Brianna stepped back and let Yuki in. The place was a mess. Clothes tossed on the furniture, coffee cups and bowls of half-eaten cereal on tables and counters, dried-out potted palms. An open bottle of vodka was centered on the coffee table. Brianna threw herself into a basket chair. Yuki sat on the edge of a facing sectional. Brianna said,
So, why are you here?
I've got good news and bad news.
For God's sake, what next? A knock-knock joke?
Yuki could do nothing but press on.
Paul Yates committed suicide, Brianna. His body was found this morning.
Brianna's expression was one of sheer disbelief. She shouted, No way!
Paul is dead? Why? Why did that creep kill himself?
According to his suicide note, it's because he regretted what he'd done to you.
Brianna got up and paced around the room. When she had completed the circuit, she came back to Yuki and said,
Bad news and good news, you said?
The DA is dropping the case against you. It's over.
Are you serious?
Absolutely,
Yuki said.
Brianna said, You're dropping the case? I'm free?
That's right.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I might have a heart attack.
Brianna's phone rang from under a throw blanket on the couch. She found it, looked at the caller ID, said,
Mom, I can't talk. The DA is here. Yes, in my fucking apartment.
Brianna clicked off the call and said to Yuki,
I'll be right back.
She went down the hallway and into another room out of Yuki's view, but Yuki heard the door slam closed. Right after that, Yuki heard Brianna screaming a loud, wordless howl. Then came cursing, more screaming. There was the sound of running water. A moment later, Brianna came back into the living room with a towel around her neck, hair dripping like she had put her head under the faucet. She dropped back into the basket chair and said,
Okay, Yuki. Tell me everything. The good, the bad, the ugly, and any other damn thing you've got.
Chapter 95. Yuki pressed on, past her own tremendous discomfort in the face of the shock Brianna was clearly feeling. She folded her hands in her lap and told Brianna about confronting Mark with Paul Yates's suicide note, and the subsequent confession from Mark 2 hours ago.
He committed crimes against you and he manipulated the justice system. We're working up charges against him now,
Yuki told her.
Extortion, perjury, criminal libel, and maybe a few other things we can throw at him once we get his signed confession.
Brianna shot out of her chair, lit up all over again. She stood over Yuki and shouted,
Throw everything at him! Do not spare him! Do you know what that maniac has done to me? He's wrecked my career, my reputation. Even my friends have lost faith in me. I can't leave the house without people taking pictures of me, pointing. She raped that cute guy. She had a gun. My privacy is gone. My dignity destroyed. My poor mother, a proud woman, is now an object of pity.
Brianna clambered back into the basket chair. She scowled, curled up, and hugged her knees, her face radiating hurt and anger. She turned her head and pinned Yuki with a hard glare.
Do you understand? Mark took everything from me. I want to write hate mail to him in jail.
Yuki said,
Brianna, I do understand. I feel terrible. Please hear me out. I came to tell you that I'm sorry for my part in what you've had to go through.
Oh, you're sorry.
Thanks. I believed Mark,
said Yuki.
The police believed Mark. His story was convincing, and if he'd been raped, as our office believed, he would have needed justice. I thought other male victims of rape would also be vindicated once this crime was exposed.
You mean I had to be exposed?
Not exactly. I'm a prosecutor. My intention was to prosecute a rapist. Brianna, I only started to suspect Mark when he testified. Even then, I thought he was making up things to make himself look better, not that the whole story was a complete fabrication.
Brianna said, Am I getting this right? Did Mark and Paul collude in this disgusting scam?
Yes,
Yuki said.
Mark admitted it was his idea, and Paul helped him. Paul apologized to you in his suicide note.
Brianna scoffed, shook her head.
Sick. Both of them. I really don't have words.
She put her feet on the floor, grabbed the stoli from the table, put the mouth of the bottle up to her lips, then stopped. She offered the bottle to Yuki.
Can't,
Yuki said.
I'm driving.
Okay, Brianna said. She took a few slugs of vodka and sighed loudly. When she turned back to Yuki, her expression had softened. She said,
You don't have to justify yourself, Yuki. You were doing your job. I respect that. I never felt that you were attacking me personally. I didn't think you were mean. If you want my forgiveness, you've got it.
I do,
said Yuki.
Thank you very much.
If Paul hadn't pulled the plug, do you think you would have won? Yuki shrugged.
You never know with juries.
Brianna said,
That horrible video. What a piece of work.
She held out the bottle to Yuki.
You're sure?
Yuki took the bottle, tipped it up, swallowed twice, and handed the bottle back.
That's my limit,
she said. Brianna smiled.
So what happens next?
You'll be hearing from James any minute now. He'll have a plan.
That's good. Jesus, I still can't believe this.
Talk about having your entire life turned inside out and then outside in.
I've got to call my mom.
The two women stood up and walked to the front door. Brianna said,
Thanks for coming.
Really.
Thank you, Brianna.
Spontaneously, they embraced and held each other for a good long minute in the doorway. Then Yuki left the apartment and walked out to her car. When she was sitting behind the wheel, she called Parisi.
How'd it go?
He asked.
I told Brianna that I was sorry. She forgave me. We both know that she'll never really get over this. It's sad.
Yuki knew that Len hadn't believed in this case, but he had believed in her. And she had absolutely misjudged Mark Christopher. She was never going to get over that. Len said,
You know what the great pitcher Satchel Paige once said?
Tell me. I'm ready,
she said.
You win a few, you lose a few, some are rained out. But you gotta dress for all of them. That's what you do and have always done. You dress for all of them. This is what rain feels like.
Thank you, Len. I appreciate that.
See you in the morning, Yuki.
Chapter 96. Their apartment was empty when Yuki came through the door. No surprise. It was still early. She thought of calling Brady, but didn't want him to blow her off.
I'm tied up here. Can I call you right back?
She kicked off her heels and dropped into her favorite chair. She called Arthur, Cindy, Lindsay, and Claire, then she turned off the ringer on her phone. She wasn't hungry or tired, so she took a bath, refilling the tub with hot water and bubble bath until she was finally just done. She dried off with the plushest towel she owned, pulled on a white cotton nightgown with buttons at the neckline and a sprinkling of lace at the hem, and got into bed. It was almost 7 o'clock. She woke up to a weight at the side of the bed. Brady. He put his hand on her shoulder and said,
Darling, are you sick?
I'm wrung out, Unbelievable day. What time is it?
She asked.
11:15, something like that.
Oh, man,
Yuki said.
I only meant to take a nap.
You need anything? Hot dogs? Ice cream?
She smiled at him in the dark.
No, I'm good,
she said. She heard Brady unbuckling his belt, throwing clothes over a chair, saying he was gonna hose off the day. When he came back, naked and damp, he said,
Scooch over a few,
and got under the covers. He took Yuki into his arms.
You smell good,
he said.
I soaked for an hour in lemongrass and citrus. I have to do that more often.
Brady said,
I heard a rumor that your case collapsed. Lindsay told me. Don't be mad at her.
It's okay. I was going to call you, but figured I'd catch you in the middle of something.
I deserve that. But you know how it is.
Not really, Brady.
She pushed away from him, creating a foot of distance between them.
I don't know. So why don't you fucking tell me?
I will. You go first, he said. Your case. What happened? Are you going to be all right with it?
Nope. No way. No chance. I've reached the end of my patience, Brady. Tell me what's going on with you or hit the couch until further notice.
He rolled onto his back, thumped the pillows into his desired support level and said,
I'm sorry, Yuki. I couldn't tell you anything. I was under a mayor-mandated Chinese wall. Politics played a part in this, and the immediate future of my job and the direction of the SFPD are under scrutiny and have been for the last 3 months.
He turned to face her.
You understand where I'm going?
Not at all,
she said.
I lost my decoder ring.
Ice cream, he said. If I'm going to break my solemn oath to the brass, I'm doing it while eating butter pecan.
Chapter 97 Brady rolled out of bed, and Yuki's mood dramatically shifted from fear of a broken marriage to alarm for her husband. What could have affected his job as well as the entire police department? Was Brady in trouble? Had he gotten embroiled in some kind of scandal? Was he being tried by the deep state of internal affairs? Beyond that, she just couldn't imagine. Brady returned to their bedroom with a bowl of ice cream, handed her one of the two spoons, and got under the covers. Yuki gripped his forearm with her free hand.
What's going on?
She asked.
Okay,
he sighed.
Here it is. The whole ugly mess. Remember last year when a half dozen cops in robbery disgraced the department?
Sure, Yuki said. A gang of them were holding up check cashing places and Western Union outlets.
That's right. Citizens were killed. Bunch of them. And while these dirtbags were robbing cash stores, they also robbed a major drug kingpin's distribution depot.
Kingfisher. I remember all of it, but how does this figure into your job?
It figures into Jacoby's job.
Jacoby?
That robbery crew was a scandal. God punished most of them, but that's really not enough. Someone in the hierarchy of the SFPD has to take the fall for a division full of corrupt cops. Head of the crew is locked up for life. Head of robbery was let go, but that's not really enough.
So you're saying that this is going to fall on the chief?
Brady said,
He's not going to be officially blamed, but he's going to be retired out. And everyone in the department will know why.
He pushed ice cream around with his spoon. Then he said,
I had to testify about all those bodies at the OK Corral. Made me sick to have to talk about that, knowing I was making the case against Jacoby. I really love the guy.
What does he know?
He knows it all. Every day after the day shift punched out, I'd go up to his office,
Brady told her.
We'd talk about every case and all the squads, go over personnel, and discuss plans for how things are going to go forward. He wants me to take his job.
He wants you to take over as chief of police?
He doesn't get a vote.
He can make a recommendation, maybe.
Yuki felt closer to her husband than she had in months, and she even understood how badly he'd been feeling, how overworked, the weight he'd been carrying. What her hurt and anger hadn't allowed her to see before. And she understood finally that Brady's distance didn't have to do with her, with them, and why he had had to keep it to himself. Their arms were tightly around each other. There was no distance between them now.
"How is he taking this?"
she asked.
"He says he wants to retire, but I'm sure this isn't how he wants to do it."
Yuki asked,
"Brady, if they put you up for the job, will you take it?"
"I don't know, darling. I like the job I have. But who would come in as chief? Levant? Or some new sheriff comes into town? That would be a game changer. I'm standing in for Jacoby while they figure out who's going to replace him."
"Starting when?"
"Any minute. Could be tomorrow or next week at the latest. Hun."
"Uh-huh."
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry I've been so out of it. I've been working two jobs and depressed beyond belief. I've been dying to talk to you."
She said,
"It's okay, love. I understand now. I feel so bad for what you've been going through."
After Brady put the bowl on the floor, Yuki reached her arms up and put them around her husband's neck. He held her close, kissing her deeply, then pulled away to fumble with the little buttons at the collar of her nightgown. When the buttons frustrated him, he pulled the slip of cotton up to her waist. She put her hands between his legs. Brady's breathing was loud in her ears, and she was burning up when he said,
"Are you going to tell me about your day?"
"No, and you can't make me."
He grinned at her as he tugged off her panties and said,
"I could just eat you up."
"Say please."
He laughed and said,
"Please, please, please, baby, please."
He pulled her legs over his hips, telling her how much he missed her and loved her. Their lovemaking was fierce and touching. It brought Yuki all the way back from anger and fear and grief to the only man she had ever really loved. She felt, as she always did in his arms, protected and adored. Connecting with Brady sent her to a place where she didn't have to be in control. She could just let go. She hoped he felt as she did, loved, understood, and safe. She was surprised when they were lying together in the afterglow, and Brady began to cry in her arms. Chapter 98. It was the day after my dramatic and embarrassing faint in the ladies' room, and I was feeling pretty good. So I called a meeting of the Women's Murder Club. I was so glad everyone was available because I truly needed an evening out with my best buds. Susie's Cafe is a mad scene on the weekend, filled with regulars and tourists and passersby drawn in by the smell of curry coming through the vents, the rhythmic plink of the steel drums, the bright ochre walls, and the jollity seen through the windows. But tonight, a Thursday, Susie's was only half filled. There were a dozen locals at the long bar, the vacant bar stools like missing teeth in an otherwise broad smile, and there was a smattering of diners in the main room. And no drums. I waved at Lorraine and took the short walk down the corridor past the takeout window to the back room. I was last to arrive at our table. Cindy stood up to let me into the booth, putting a steadying hand around my arm as I edged in, asking me if I was okay.
"I need a drink," I said.
"Hear, hear," said Claire.
Her hand was in the air, and Lorraine materialized with a glass for me and a refill on the pitcher of brew.
"What'd I miss?" I asked the girls.
Claire said,
"I was just talking about my little one."
"Keep talking," I said.
Ruby Rose was 4, a child with a big personality.
"We were at Target," Claire said. "I am looking for new soft tread shoes, and Rosie is right next to me."
"Then she's not."
I start screaming, "Rosie, Rosie, Rosie!" I'm picturing the posters on the telephone poles, and I am well on my way to pure freaking panic. Then,
There she is. I see her one aisle over. Rosie has seen a dress she just has to have. She has pulled off all her clothes in the middle of the store except for panties that say, Mama's Girl.
There's a big relief, I said, feeling it. Julie is younger than Rosie, but she has shown potential to live up to a frightening public display like that one. Claire went on.
I say, Rosie, no, you can't get naked in public. She says, God likes naked kids. I say, please, Rosie, put your clothes on, please. She says, loud, so everyone in the whole store can hear, Mom, how many times do I have to tell you? I hate it when you beg.
Yuki's infectious peal of laughter carried across the back room, and we were all swept up in it when Lorraine appeared and said,
Sorry to interrupt, but we're about to run out of shrimp.
When our orders were on the way to the kitchen, I said to Yuki,
Spill, girlfriend. Last I heard, the DA dropped the charges against Brianna Hill.
She said, That's correct. And for the cherry on top, the ad shop is giving Brianna her old job back.
A chorus of yahoos and thank gods rose up around the table, and Yuki said,
I'll drink to that.
We all did. And then Claire turned to me and asked, How are you doing, Linz? What did the doctor say? Nothing just yet. Dr. Arpino gave me a hell of a workup this morning. Pulled a whole lot of blood. So now we're waiting for test results. I'm scared, guys. I have to admit it. I'm afraid it could be aplastic anemia.
But you kicked it, Cindy said. Didn't you?
I'd had aplastic anemia years before I married Joe, years before Julie. Back then, when I was diagnosed with that wretched and often fatal disease, I actually put my gun into my mouth before common sense and survival instinct pulled me back. I had so much more to live for now. I said, Even if the symptoms disappear, it can come back. I haven't told Joe what's freaking me out. He thinks I'm just working too hard. I don't want to scare him unless I'm sure. I don't want to break his heart. Yuki had grabbed a paper napkin and was weeping into it.
I'm sorry,
she blubbered.
Take the booze away from me.
Cindy put an arm around Yuki and drained her glass. She said to me,
You're not scared alone, Lindsay. We're all here.
Claire added, Call us as soon as you hear. I promised. Yuki said,
Tell Joe. You have to tell him. He needs to go through this with you, and you need him too.
Group hug, I said. We all stood up awkwardly in our booth and hugged across the table. I hoped this love and friendship would steady me until I saw Dr. Arpino again. Chapter 99. The next day, early in the morning, I drove up Lake Street to 12th, but instead of heading to the hall, I took a right onto 10th, turned again onto California Street, and kept going. Dr. Arpino's office was on a tidy block of houses on Broderick Street, many of which doubled as doctor's offices. I didn't have to check the house numbers. I knew the place. A gray shingled Victorian with dormers and white trim and a mailbox painted with flowers. I stopped the car at the curb and sat there with the motor running. I thought about how when I'd gotten home last night, Joe had been almost glowing with good news.
I got the job, Blondie.
And it's the job you want? I asked him.
Turns out that Dick Benjamin Rollins and I have some friends in common.
Wow. No kidding, Joe. This is amazing. I'd hugged and kissed him, thinking this new job had come through at just the right time. If the worst happened, the stuff of my nightmares, the Molinari family would have one income anyway, and probably a good one. I was due in Doc Arpino's office in 10 minutes, and he was usually on time. I turned on the radio to Jazz 91 and listened to something by the late, great Miles Davis. While Blue in Green carried the seconds along, I took out my phone and checked my incoming mail. There was nothing but spam to distract me. I opened the junk mail folder and imagined no more snoring. Considered an urgent request for money to get my friend safely back from Europe, and imagined a trip to the Bahamas for only $77 a night, all expenses included. The Bahamas. If only. I dropped my phone back into my bag and watched a school bus stop on the opposite side of the street to pick up a kiddo, who dashed off his front steps and climbed up into the big yellow bus. Then the bus was on the move, and as it passed me, I put my car in gear and drove up the street to the intersection at Union. I slowed for the stop sign and came to a full stop. I watched an old man clipping his doorstep hedges. A calico cat trotted across the street, and when it was safely home, I revved my engine. I was running away. This was not my usual style, and I knew that I was being crazy.
I had to go to see the doc.
I drummed my fingers on the wheel. Not going.
Going.
Not going. A car honked behind me and I put my foot on the gas. My hands spun the wheel to the right, and I turned onto Union, then I took another right onto Divisadero. I took two more right turns in this pretty neighborhood that looked as though it had been ripped from a storybook tale ending with, "And they lived happily ever after." Having circled Doc Arpino's block, I parked again beside the pansy-painted mailbox. I sighed. I dragged myself out of my car and put one foot in front of the other until I'd reached the top of the doctor's front steps. I rang the bell and opened the door. Chapter 100. I put the doctor's office in my rear view and drove to the hall on autopilot. I parked on Harriet Street, under the rumbling roof of Interstate 80, and in a few minutes Brady crossed the alley and got into my passenger seat. He looked at me, did a double take, and said,
"You're scaring me, Boxer."
I nodded as if I knew what I was going to say or do. One option was to go for the weekly B12 shots and, at the same time, go to work as usual and hope for the best. That meant no all-night stakeouts, firefights, or hand-to-hand combat with insane gunmen. In other words, I could not safely do what I called my job. Or I could get the weekly shots and take a medical leave, as directed by my doctor. During that time, Conklin would get a new partner, and I would lose my place in homicide. I just hated that thought. It was roughly equivalent to closing my eyes and jumping into a sinkhole. I said, "Brady, my condition is, how can I say this? It's serious. I have something called pernicious anemia."
"You're saying you're anemic?"
"It's a form of anemia. The causes are various and so are the symptoms, but it has to do with my blood being unable to absorb vitamin B12. If I don't deal with this situation pronto, it could damage organs and nerves, or could become something worse. Years back, I had aplastic anemia, and that really could have killed me." Brady kept his eyes fixed on me. He was reading me.
"This pernicious kind. You're heading it off right now, right? And so you say it's treatable? Reversible?"
"I've got a good doctor. I need shots every week for a while, and Doc wants me to take time off."
"Please, Boxer. Do what you're supposed to do. Take whatever time you need."
"He says a couple of months. He said I have to do a whole mind and body reset. Sleep, you know, whatever that is. Meditation would be good. See him on schedule. Get better." Brady smiled.
"You, lying around the house."
I tried to smile back, then I shook my head. Brady put his hand on my arm.
"Be a good girl. Will you, Boxer?"
"Yes, I will. I have no choice." Brady said,
"I might as well tell you something you're going to hear soon anyway."
"Shoot," I said. Brady checked his phone, sent someone a reply, then came back to me. He told me that Jacoby was being retired out as a result of a case Conklin and I had worked about a year and a half ago involving a crew of dirty cops. After the fallout, the body count had been, all told, about 19 guilty and innocent souls. I said to Brady, "IAD is hanging it on Jacoby?"
"Accountability goes with the job,"
he said. I felt tears welling up. Not only was I at a personal low, I was taking this blame Jacoby news personally.
Who is replacing him? I asked.
Brady shrugged.
To be decided.
Then he said, go home, Lindsay.
Fight this pernicious anemia. It's something you have control over. Other than that, don't worry about a thing. It'll all work out somehow. You get better, and when you get a green light from your doctor, come back. Not a second before.
He leaned over, kissed my cheek, said,
love you, Linz. Be good to yourself. I'll talk to you soon.
Then he got out of my car. I sat there and watched him cross Harriet Street and disappear behind a line of parked cars on his way up to the squad room.
Don't worry about a thing, he'd said. What? Me? Worry?
But he was right. I counseled myself to get a grip on the one thing I might be able to use to save myself. I had to stay home. Spend more time with Julie and Joe and Martha. It would be quite interesting to find out who I was when not working a homicide case. I couldn't put it off any longer. I had to go home and give Joe the news. Chapter 101. I hadn't seen Jacoby since the hammer came down, but I'd called him the day after he walked out of the hall for the last time to ask how he was doing.
You know how it is, Boxer. Sometimes you're the dog, sometimes you're the tree.
I commiserated. For different reasons, we were both feeling like trees. We had a breakfast date this morning. Not in the break room with passed-over donuts, but at an actual eatery in Jacoby's section of town. He lives in Hayes Valley. Gentrified not long ago, it has shaken off the rough edges and is now littered with cute little restaurants and bars and boutiques, a nice place to visit. Jacoby's house holds down the end of a block on Ivy Street and is one of many single-family and multi-family wood-frame houses built closely together, facing sidewalks lined with young, red-flowering gum trees. I parked my Explorer behind my old friend's Hyundai SUV and called him on the phone.
Lindsay?
Who else?
You're not the only woman I know,
he said, laughing.
I'll be right down.
A couple of minutes later, he came down the zigzag of wooden steps from his living quarters over his wide-body garage. He looked the same as always, gray-haired with hooded eyes, walking with a limp, and wearing a leather flight jacket handed down to him from an uncle who'd fought in the Korean War. But he looked different to me now. He hadn't aged, it was nothing as obvious as that. He didn't even look depressed. He looked lighter. Like a man who had been retired before he was ready to go, but was glad that the load was off his back. He was grinning when he crossed the street, and I crossed the street toward him. We opened our arms and hugged in the middle of Ivy, and man, it felt good. Jacoby had stood in for my awful father before, and he was doing it now, even as I had come to comfort him. He might have heard my strangled sob.
Do not go wobbly on me, Boxer. I may be fat, I may be pushing 60, but here I am.
Let's get out of the road, I said, so that those aren't your last words. Playa del Oro was a little Mexican joint sandwiched between a shoe repair shop and an art gallery. We ordered huevos rancheros and tea, and talked about how we'd come to this unexpected place in our lives. He said,
Boxer, I'm not an innocent party. I didn't know Ted Swanson had assembled a robbery crew, but I should have known. I have to be accountable. If I were the mayor, geez Louise, someone had to pay. Obviously, the buck stopped at my door. And hey, it came with full retirement pay.
That part is awesome, I said.
And pretty soon, Medicare.
Jacoby grinned broadly, looking lighter and younger by the minute. He said,
But enough about me. Tell me how you're doing. Don't leave anything out.
I told him, I feel pretty good, but like I'm playing hooky. I'm supposed to be on the job. I mean, shit happens and then you die, right?
But this is a case of shit happens and you get to stay home, watch movies, and collect a paycheck.
Go figure, said Jacoby. We've got the same deal. But there's upside for both of us. Your job is to rest up and heal. Mine is to get back to my fighting weight. My doctor told me to lose the bowling ball or else, and when he described or else, I definitely didn't want it.
I pointed to the dish of chocolate chili cake with a side of churros our waitress had put down in front of us, and he laughed.
I know, but this is a special occasion, old friend. I'm going to cut down on the carbs and start walking. I might get a dog.
How about this, Chief? Why don't we get together to walk my dog every week or so? Or our dogs. We could go to a museum once in a while. Take in a ball game. Fight back against enforced home confinement.
I like the sound of that, Boxer.
We grinned at each other, reached across the small round table laden with sweets, and shook on it. I said,
we're both fighters.
Jacoby said,
and fighters win.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The 17th Suspect, written by James Patterson and Maxine Petro. Read by January Lavoie. Produced by Cheryl Smith. Directed by Dante Hodge. Recorded by Listen Up Audiobooks. Post-production by Beat Street NYC. The 17th Suspect is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by James Patterson. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.